Fads come and go, and nowhere more than in the world of weight loss. That's why Noom's weight management programs are made to last. Noom uses science and personalization to help you manage your weight for the long term. Their psychology-based approach helps you build better habits and behaviors that are easier to maintain. The best part? You decide how Noom fits into your life, not the other way around. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com to sign up for your trial today.
Before we get started with this episode of Bench with Bubba, I wanted to talk to you guys about the MLB Roto Baller Challenge, hosted by our friends at Fantrax on Fantrax.com. Fantrax is the most customizable free fantasy baseball platform in the industry, and that's why we're hosting over our 2022 Roto Baller Challenge over on Fantrax. If you want the greatest fantasy experience, sign up for a free Roto Baller Challenge team today by going to rotoballer.com/challenge. All leagues are free to join, and you get to compete against Roto Baller writers and readers for a shot at $500 cash grand prize. All new Fantrax users get entered into a free giveaway to win a signed official MLB Wander Franco jersey. If you want to get entered to win a Wander Franco jersey and you're new to Fantrax, go to Fantrax.com/Bubba and sign up for your free Fantrax account today. Once you have your Fantrax account, go to rotoballer.com/challenge to join the Challenge League, but go to Fantrax.com/Bubba to create your Fantrax account, be entered to win a Wander Franco autographed jersey. But for now, welcome to Benched with Bubba. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Benched with Bubba, episode 451. Got some more hot stove action to talk about with a lot of fantasy impacts as free agency has gone bananas, trades because two teams just don't care about baseball anymore, and much, much more. But it's also the heart of draft season, so it's very, very important right now. So I have a special guest joining me. I'm glad I was able to get in touch with him and line this out because he's a great, great individual, especially in the fantasy baseball community. I had the pleasure of meeting him at First Pitch Arizona back in October, and I can't wait again until I believe it's November this year based on the back of the Forecaster. He is the co-general manager of Baseball HQ, the co-editor of the Forecaster, the one, the only, Ray Murphy. How we doing, man?
I am doing great. Thanks so much for the invite. This is going to be a ball.
Yeah, it's going to be an absolute blast, and he writes at HQ, of course. You can hear him usually on the your guys' weekly podcast once we get in season. So, yeah, there's a lot of great stuff coming out at HQ. So before we get started, why don't you go ahead and let people kind of know about what they can get over at Baseball HQ?
Sure, we could do that. All sorts of things. You did a great job of summarizing, but you know, right now the focus is on the Baseball HQ website, where we are cranking out fantasy content analysis on a I don't even know if hourly basis covers it at this time of year, right? I was literally uploading projection adjustments right before I came on the air with you, tweaking Chris Bryant to Colorado and stuff like that. But that's where the focus is now. You know, we have you know, all the tools and analysis you need for your fantasy season. HQ is the online component, and as you mentioned, the Baseball Forecaster is the is the book form that comes
it's the
out.
Gold it's the gold standard. Like, we don't have to sugarcoat it. I'm pretty sure if you play fantasy baseball and you don't use the Forecaster, well, you're already starting off behind. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, it's a funny point in the calendar. I appreciate the kind words there. It's a funny point in the calendar where the focus does shift from the book, which gets so much attention from, you know, the day before Thanksgiving when we drop the PDF out, through January, February. And if anything, you know, given the lockout and the lack of player movement, it held up a little bit better than usual this year, right? But now that the the player movement is in full swing and everything. The book still has its uses, but there's no substitute for being able to tweak a projection online and publish it right out to people. So they go hand in hand, and they each serve their purposes, and those are our the two tent poles that we're known for. You mentioned the place where I met you in person, First Pitch Arizona. I believe the dates are actually November 3rd through 6th this year, so we'll be back out in person at the Arizona Fall League for a 3.5 day weekend symposium. We watch AFL games. We talk baseball morning, noon, and night. There's even a little bit of, poker, beer exchange, and other kind of stuff like that. It's only 93% baseball content, but it's just a glorious weekend that, people do go, not just me who put it on with Brent and my friends at HQ, but, people who attend can't say enough good things about it. And that's why we keep doing it, because people love it so much.
Yeah, like I've said it many times on the show since I went there, like between Toby and I talking about it and guests on the show that were there and everything. It's more than just a fantasy baseball event. It's just a baseball event. Like, it's just people that love baseball, because just sitting at the ballpark, you kind of go and hang out with different people. You have Twitter personas. We have never met in person. We don't know each other. But then all of a sudden you realize we all have something in common and we all love baseball. And then you go to the seminars or the little side sessions. It's a blast, absolute blast. So I told people, even if you're not like diehard fantasy baseball players, you should go. You really should, because you will gain a ton out of it. It's pretty darn awesome. So I'm definitely looking forward to it this year. And I think, like you guys said, it's in November, which hopefully lines up with the Fall Stars this year, which will be pretty darn awesome.
That is the hope. We don't usually get that confirmed until the AFL schedule comes out in mid-August or so. But, if the schedule follows the pattern, we should get it, I think. So we'll find out for sure. But either way,
it worked out fine last year.
It worked out fine. You get extra games if there's no Fall Stars game, is the way it works out. You get a Saturday doubleheader instead of the Fall Stars game. So there's really no losing.
True. And I was going to ask you after we talked about all the players, but I'll kind of get to it because you mentioned it. So the projections, this is a daunting task these days for anybody that does projections, because like you said, it was kind of like radio silent forever. And you're used to kind of some news coming out and ADP moving, and you're taking things as it comes out. But now it's like all just a rush all at the same time. So how are you guys going about these projections and tweaking things? Is it just all like all hands on deck? Are you the main source of this? How's that all going for you guys?
Yeah, it works a couple of different ways. I can give you a sort of a little peek under the hood. There's sort of, as anybody who dabbles in projections will tell you, there's two components, right? There's the playing time and there's the performance. Everyone's got sort of a baseline per at bat, per plate appearance stat line, and then you just overlay another number of plate appearances or innings on that, and then you put those together and you get a projection, right? The way we do it at HQ is I'm responsible for the performance component. So I build all of the per at bat projections. And then we've got tools on the site where the writers who cover each team or each division who are closest to those teams handle the playing time allocations. And they go and, bump somebody from 65% playing time to 80%. And then every night we run our projections, and those changes can happen automatically without me doing anything, right? So I don't need to, the performance side hasn't changed, so I don't need to be involved in that process. That can all sort of run on its own. But when you either add a new player to the system, or a player changes teams, or there's another reason to go manually sort of put your thumb on the scale of the performance component of the projection, that's where I come in. And mostly during the off season and even during the season, with the exception of the trading deadline, that's probably once, twice a week task for me, because there aren't trades happening all the time. If there's a waiver claim, usually those are pretty innocuous players, and I can get away for a couple of days without changing Edward Olivares's performance when he gets waived for the seventh time and picked up by another team, right? No one's really going to notice that. But right now, with the flood of transactions we've got going on here, I'm touching projections multiple times a day, which is better than a lockout, right? This is in no 100%. This is in no way a complaint, but it's a little out of the ordinary for me. And honestly, while I will again say it's not a complaint, there are also other things I need to be doing. So having 3-4 hours of projection work, multiple days a week, multiple iterations a day. They don't all take 3 or 4 hours, but they probably add up to that when I'm opening up the hood two, three times a day here. Hey, it's a good problem to have, but the sooner these guys want to sign and get us back into sort of a normal maintenance mode of the projections, I'm okay with that.
No doubt about it. And that's what I wanted to ask, because I know you guys pretty much update them like every evening, it feels like, or by the next morning, and there's like another run of projections. Because for those that use draft software like Rotolab and everything, you literally have to go and update it every time you log in every day, because you guys have a fresh run that comes out. And not all projections do that. Some do it like every couple days or whatever, but it's kind of fun to see. Like, I guess I'm just a nerd at times with this. I never thought I'd say that, but I enjoy going and looking, okay, what's the new projection? Because like Jesse Winker, they talk about it, like, Derek Hardy tweeted it out, Rudy Gamble tweeted out, like all of their projection sites, they're very smart projection guys too. They dropped them tremendously for going to Seattle. And you know, you usually don't see massive changes like that. Then you go to Baseball HQ and you see the changes there. It's just like, for me, it's fun to kind of put, I guess, validation or some clarification behind certain moves as you're trying to analyze for, like, as you're drafting, because we are in the heart of draft season. We're playing baseball in like 2.5 weeks, like maybe three weeks. So we're going to be ramping up drafts like crazy. So we got to figure these out quickly. And the projections are huge. That's why I wanted to ask you about it, because it's, I guess it's a thankless job at times, like you said, the 3 to 4 hours you're doing. But I know there's lots of us that are like,
yeah, it's got to get done. It's, yeah, 100%. Exactly. You actually hit on a component I didn't talk about, which is the Rotolab component. You know, when I publish projections to the website, there's the nightly update that, happens every night, and they're usually up on the site by about 8 a.m. And if I want to do another update during the day, I can push the button and they go out immediately. But you're right. For the Rotolab population that exclusively gets HQ projections, and to your point, always want the latest version, every time I hit the publish button here, I basically have to shoot an email to Merv at Rotolab. Like, hey, Merv, there's another set out there. And, our projections run in the morning. Merv tends to be a night owl. So, we try to keep him in sync. I do stay in close in touch with him, especially at this time of year in March, as we get to the weekends where, he's putting out 2-3 updates a day. And I want to make sure that, we're sort of synchronized so that someone's going to their Saturday night draft or something like that, that they didn't miss the 5 o'clock update because I published it at 5, but Merv grabbed the latest numbers at 4:30. That's not a good system. So we try to avoid that by just staying in touch. Merv is on the email equivalent of whatever my speed dial is, at this time of year for sure.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, I got other questions, but I know they're going to come out when we talk to these players, because it'll all help with the analysis of what's going on. So in no particular order, let's talk about moves for the last like 3 days. The last time I did a fantasy hot stove update was, I believe, Tuesday morning. So we've got about 3 days worth of news here, which still fills up a whole show. So don't worry, folks.
I may have to order out for food for 3 days of moves. Yeah,
it's ridiculous. It's crazy. But Freddie Freeman, as much of I'm a diehard Giants fan, so this pains me tremendously, but I knew it was coming. It was pretty obvious for a long time, to me at least. Freddie Freeman goes to the Los Angeles Dodgers, and it just makes this Los Angeles Dodgers team ridiculous. Like, I guess the analysis is pretty simple. He's going to be good in LA. But how does this break down to you? Is he still like the top first baseman off the board to you? What's it maybe do to surrounding players on that Dodgers roster for you from a fantasy standpoint?
Yeah, that last component might be the more interesting part, because from a projection point of view for Freeman himself, but running him through the conversion model from Atlanta to LA did virtually nothing. He lost 4 points of batting average, as I'm looking at it here. And, the model said he might have lost a little bit of counting stats too. Runs and RBIs are down a bit. But this is one of those cases where I'm actually wondering if a second revision is in order, just because of what you were talking about, because, the team context is just so good. And I'm not sure that the part, what primarily got weighted in there and dinging him a couple of RBIs and runs is the park factor change from Atlanta to LA. But I'm wondering if the lineup context doesn't just completely wipe that out. So that's one where I got to go back in my next update tomorrow or over the weekend and take yet another look and maybe put a little bit back on him. But it's not like he lost anything remarkable as it is. And geez, that, I don't even care what order you put in Turner, Betts, Freeman, Will Smith, and Bellinger could just hit seventh and see if he can figure out how to hit again, right? No one's gonna care. It's just I saw some comparisons online today that were comparing this lineup to like the 1995 Indians as like the best lineups this, you know, this century, or, you know, in our lifetimes. And, you know, it seems like it's in that neighborhood now. Of course, they still have to go out and do it and stay healthy and all that stuff, but, you know, they can lose a lot and still be a good offense,
as they tend to do so well. And it's crazy, like, roster resource, never the end all be all, like I always say, but AJ Pollock's projected hit ninth.
Yeah.
It's just insane what they have in that team. I guess, like, the only caveats I can think of with Freeman moving to first, now Bellinger's pretty much strictly in the outfield because there was chances he'd move to first base. With Muncy's shoulder, you knew he was pretty much DH only, but he definitely takes him out of first base if that was an option. And by moving Belly to the outfield, it takes, you know, Chris Taylor out of there. So in the end, I think Gavin Lux is the biggest loser in this deal. And
yeah,
that's tough.
Yeah, it's tough. I like Lux a lot. I was chasing him in a bunch of drafts back in January. It does seem like, you know, the outlook is a little reduced there. You know, the other thing that we briefly brush over that matters a lot there is with the DH clog, especially with Muncy, and now with Muncy not playing first, you know, playing first base because Freeman's there. I was super excited a month ago when we were still locked out, but they had agreed to the DH that, you know, Will Smith was going to find his way to, like, you know, full-time plate appearances, that he was going to, you know, catch 5 days a week and DH the other two and get to 550 plate appearances, just put up monster numbers. And, you know, at least until Muncy can get in the field, that's the door on that is probably shut for the moment. So that's a little bit disappointing, but what can you do? There's just an embarrassment of riches here.
Pretty much. It's what the Dodgers do. I love watching them all season long. Colorado Rockies will stay in the division here. Chris Bryant, besides the fact we don't know what the Rockies ever do, like, they're still paying for Nolan Arenado, they're not going to pay Trevor Story, but let's bring Chris Bryant in for 7 years. That's confusing. But they brought Bryant in. We know Coors Field, and he's projected, Bud Black said, to play left field full time, which basically kicks out Connor Joe and company. So what's your thoughts on Bryant and Coors Field?
Yeah, the who loses the playing time was sort of, you know, the immediate thought. And I guess I sort of expected left field more than third base because I didn't think they would go down the path of bumping McMahon back to second and, you know, and then Rogers to shortstop, which I'm not sure they were that comfortable with, especially after they had just signed Iglesias. So that didn't make a lot of sense. And you remember before the lockout that, you know, we weren't LOL Rockies quite that hard, but, you know, they did spend a lot of time trying to sort of retain their B and C list free agents. You know, no interest in Story or Gray, but boy, it's important that we bring back CJ Cron and Antonio Sensatello from our fourth place team. You know, we got to make sure the core's in place.
That's too good.
But so, you know, given they had made those the investment in Cron, and, you know, presumably they like Rogers, then, you know, it seemed like it was going to be left field. But, you know, but that's just still a domino falls, and it's not clear that they have a real DH solution that could be the revolving door there. It could be Cron, could be Bryant, could be McMahon. So Bryant, I wouldn't be surprised if Bryant retains third base eligibility for another year at least. But it sounds like left field, I mean, he's going to hit there. That's, you know, from a Bryant fantasy perspective, there's no bad news. I was running the projection through the engine right before we came on the air, and he picks up, you know, 4 or 5 home runs and, you know, 15 RBIs, that kind of thing. But, you know, the real impact is the batting average because of that, you know, that expanse in the outfield. It's like, for us, it was 17 points of batting average or something, which is just, you know, that just makes a difference really quickly. So, you know, all good news for Chris Bryant. And hey, if you're a Rockies fan, they're more fun to watch with Chris Bryant. I tweeted something today that said, I think the real problem with this signing is that I don't think the Rockies front office thinks they're the fourth or fifth best team in the NL West the way they actually are. But, you know, that's a problem for another day. That's not a fantasy problem.
I guess if you're a fan, at least they try to give you false hope. I don't know. I'd say it could be the Reds. It could be worse.
100%. Yeah. I mean,
but I'm with you. I get what you're saying. Like,
it's a different category of incompetence for sure.
Bingo. That's so well said. And Rob DiPietro's checking in. He says, hello, young men. So Rob's watching.
Hey, Rob.
Always a fan of Rob DiPietro. But Yeah, Chris Bryant in the month of March on online championships, ADP is 96, but he's gone as high as 68, which I'm assuming is like the last day or two. Do you probably see where would you kind of? I'm not a Chris Bryant guy. Now, the batting average boost in Coors Field is way more attractive to me. But where would you see a good landing spot ADP-wise for a Chris Bryant?
I think the interesting question for me that I probably need to go take a closer look at is, you know, to use the Rocky comparison, I would have him above Arenado now. And the decision point for me would probably – I probably got to take another look at him versus Riley. That's probably – where I need to figure out how I'm going to slot him in. He's behind Ramirez, Machado, and Devers, but he's either right above Riley or right behind him, I would say.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I never really considered the two, but if you give the batting average bump there in Coors Field, you're going to get some stolen bases with Bryant. It's a lot closer now than I think I would have given it credit for to begin with. And if you guys at HQ want to take this one and run with it, a person in one of my chats that I hold, it was like a year or two ago when the Rockies started really just screwing things up in the front office. They named them the Mountain Mets, if it makes you feel any better.
I like it. I like it a lot.
So run with that one if you'd like. The Toronto Blue Jays, like there were rumors they were in on Freddie. They were in on J-Ram. I still hope they'd love to make that move. That'd be awesome. But they went and traded for Matt Chapman, which is tremendous. We know Chapman's been having the hip injuries and other injuries. That's kind of zapped his overall offensive production. There's a lot of swing and miss in his bat. We get it. But the glove is undeniable. And so what's your thoughts on Chapman and maybe his overall value in fantasy? But also, there's Ben Palmer, a pitcher, has put out a great thread on how it'll benefit the pitchers because many of those guys have ground. Like, it's just those little things that most people don't look at, and then you see it, you're like, oh, my goodness. So how do you see like his production and how he helps the team?
Let me start off by saying that if we're going to call the Rockies the Mountain Mets, if the Jays get Jose Ramirez, they are the Canadian Dodgers, okay?
Fair.
But that said, on what they actually have on their roster right now with Chapman, yeah, that was a great thread from Palmer. I saw that too with the – that was the one that had the heat chart the of where Ryu's ground balls will go, and they were right to Chapman, right?
And then he had another one on that. If I think it was like two more tweets down, it had all the other four starters, and it's almost – it's not as in-depth, but almost all the same. It was crazy.
I can only imagine that the Ryu chart looks exactly the same for Kikuchi now, right? Too. Yep. So, you know, that makes a ton of sense. And, you know, on the Jays roster, it's just such a perfect fit because he didn't think they were really going to play both Santiago Espinal and Kevin Biggio at second and third, right? So now those guys can go over to second base and duke it out there and bat ninth and not worry about it. And, you know, this lineup that, you know, I was talking with Patrick Davitt on our show, Baseball HQ Radio, this week too. And we were, you know, Chapman, you're talking about what the projection does for him, you know, say it's the same kind of thing as we saw, you know, it's not as expansive on batting average as Bryant's move to Colorado was, but, you know, he picks up three or four home runs going from Oakland to Toronto, Chapman does. But really the question there is health. And, you know, we got to, you know, after playing with the hip for all of last year, we got to see what condition he's in. But, you know, offensively, I'm not sure the Jays are that concerned, right? Yeah. I mean, he's going to bat seventh, and as long as he, you know, does the vacuum cleaner routine over at third base and pops some home runs and stays in the lineup, you know, they got other guys to do the thumping.
Yep. No doubt about it. Does it move up the pitchers at all for you, or is it more just like, this is cool, maybe like a few picks, or is it like a massive jump for you at all?
It's not a massive jump, but just because of the division context, you know, that it's just such a scary place still to deal with. And maybe it does for the lefties a little bit. Maybe, you know, I've been sort of off for you. We had a conversation at First Pitch Florida, which online, which we did a couple weekends ago. I think it was we were talking to Derek Van Riper, and he said like, yeah, you guys put a down on Ryu in the forecaster, which is like, you know, just like basically writing in red ink, do not draft. And you know, it was just a reminder that, you know, he was joking with us about like, you know, how much weight that carries when we actually like stick our neck out on the downside. And, you know, maybe that, you know, is looking a little bit overly pessimistic in this context because the team is so good, because the defense is so good, and he's such a beneficiary of Chapman. But, you know, he's going to be terrifying every time you know, they face the Yankees, Red Sox, or Rays, which is, what, 70 times?
Well, let's speak about that for a second. So most of these guys are – there's like chunks of teams not going to Toronto. There's going to be apparently the Mets and Yankees – for some act, can't go play on their own stadium yet. The opposing team's non-vaccinated. But I don't want to get the politics of this part, but we're going to be missing players potentially in games. And that could change by tomorrow morning, of course. Yeah. Like a lot can change. But for now, say you are drafting, does that bump them down a couple rounds for you? Or are you just like, you know what, like cooler heads or smarter people will prevail by the time we get going on this?
It's interesting how to think about this, like, because it's come up in a couple of contexts. Like, you know, there was a bunch of talk about the Red Sox. You know, I'm a Boston guy, and you know, the Red Sox obviously had some issues last year with not being vaccinated, and you know, there were some concerns about who would be able to go to Toronto and New York and who wouldn't. Xander Bogaerts came out and said this week that he is vaccinated now. He was one of the ones who was not last year. So that kind of eased the concern. And then Chris Sale got hurt. He's not vaccinated. Yeah,
so you don't have to worry about him.
He can't pitch anyway, so who cares? Yeah. But then, you know, if you take it to the New York context, which I think is the more
crazy one. It's like maybe half a season.
Crazy and also flexible. I try to apply logic to these situations. I don't understand how the Yankees could give Anthony Rizzo $32 million if they didn't know he could play in Yankee Stadium.
That's a very good point.
Now, I don't know if that means he's vaccinated and just being super coy about it, or if they just know they're going to hand the mayor a suitcase of money and have this taken care of. Yeah. But one way or the other, I got to believe that the New York problem is going to be solved, at least for Anthony Rizzo, because, you know, they gave Anthony Rizzo a pile of money, and you know, Aaron Judge needs to play for them. I one way or the other, the New York situation must be flexible for the Yankees to have made that commitment. Now, okay. The counter to that is everything I can read on the Canadian situation is that is not flexible at all, and that is not changing. So, yeah, everyone, you're going to have a lot of four-day NFBC lineups or whatever where you're guys are going to Toronto, and it might as well be like Nelson Cruz going to an NL park in 2019, right? True. You're just going to sit him down and he's not getting on the plane, and you're going to have to pick up a reserve, because I think that's going to be how it plays out. I don't think that's going to change. But the New York thing seemed like it would be more impactful because they couldn't play at all, and there are two teams there and all of those things. And it seems to me like the Yankees think that's going to work out and have put their money where their mouth is.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of with you on that one, because like when that came out and the Toronto thing came out, I'm sitting there going, okay, we just went through a lockout. We're talking about, you know, integrity of the game. We want all these even playing fields. Why don't they just move these teams to Florida then? And like we did with Dunedin. Like, if it's that big of a deal, you think, but no one's like flinching about this. So like you said, maybe there's way more to it, that at least the New York thing gets figured out. Maybe Canada does by then. Who knows? I doubt it. Doesn't sound like it, but we'll see. It's just crazy to me to think that that's where we are right now after everything we've been through. But yeah, those are the breaks. So I guess the biggest thing I'd say is you don't have to maybe push guys down your draft board, but maybe don't stack a lot of AL East players.
Yeah, that's a fair way to look at it. don't do a lot of stacking. And you know, I think there's also an argument for you know, being mindful of it in your bench construction too, and some of your, you know, paying attention to some of your, how you're allocating your multi-position guys and how you're using your bench slots and making sure that, you know, you can, you know, we all got used to, in certainly in 2020 and even last year, the, you know, random COVID IL appearances and having to juggle our rosters all over the place. And let, you know, you may want to retain a little bit of the mindset that you went through with that, because
that was a headache.
It's not going to be as bad, we hope, but it's not going away altogether either.
Yep. As Rob DiPietro says, I know a guy who knows a guy. He said, draft New Yorkers with confidence. I can just picture him in his accent saying that as well.
Leave the cannoli, draft the New Yorkers.
Exactly. He's going to hang out with Modica and the boys, and they're going to be talking at the draft table. The Phillies, they made a big splash. This one kind of surprised me. I knew Schwarber was getting shopped around, but they brought Schwarber in to that beautiful ballpark for his left-handed swing, and they gave him a good pile of cash too. So they're going to play him pretty darn regularly, either at DH or in the outfield. This has to be quite the boost to Schwarber, at least in my opinion, because there's a lot of other landing spots that actually obviously wouldn't have been so good. So what's your thoughts on Schwarber in Philadelphia?
Yeah, a great landing spot. You know, I really enjoyed the heck out of him in Boston for the second half of last year. And, you know, I have every I was on him even before knowing where he was going to land, and I would fully expect him to just rake. You know, on the flip side of the coin, the Dave Dombrowski seems to have just completely eschewed defense. So, you know, this may not be good news for the Aaron Nola rebound fan club, that sort of thing, because apparently the poor defense will continue until morale improves or something.
That's okay. He plays the outfield. If it's a fly ball, it's gone on Nola anyways. So it's okay. It's not that big a deal. You mentioned Anthony Rizzo a second ago. He heads to the Bronx there. And, you know, the time there last year was kind of up and down, but his last couple seasons have been up and down. Like, it's one of those profiles when you go look at the end stat line, it wasn't, like, crushing. But it felt like if you rostered him every week, you're just like, where's Anthony Rizzo? Like, what's going on here? So what's your thoughts on him coming back to New York? And what's going on with Luke Voit?
Yeah, Rizzo coming back to New York is interesting. I thought the structure of the contract was interesting. This isn't necessarily a, you know, hot fantasy take, but he got 2 years, $60 million each year, but he got an opt-out after the first year. And it's that the first thing that came to mind when I saw that is he wants to get back on the market when the shift is banned. Yep. And, you know, because he's been, you know, traditionally one of the guys who really gets wrecked by that. And sure, for this year, Yankee Stadium's a great place for him to hang out and try to jerk balls into the short porch. If he puts up a reasonable year and looks like, you know, he's got some mileage left and a couple, he can go back on the market and get a multi-year deal from somebody who's thinking that there's a no shift bounce for him in 2023. My counter argument, my longer term concern there is he's obviously got a history of back problems, and you know, I'm a lot older than 32, but I'm old enough to know that back problems don't get better from age 32 on. So, you know, I think that casts a shadow over sort of the entire outlook here. And then you never know when you talked about how he disappears for stretches. You never know when it's a couple of weeks of I slept on my back wrong in St. Louis, and, you know, the last 3 weeks I've been kind of dragging my ass around since. And he's not going to tell you that, but, you know, when he goes quiet for a couple of weeks at a time, I'm always wondering if that's what happened. And, you know, I think that's the rest of his career at this point.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm approaching the old 40 turn in life, and back problems don't go away at all. Yeah. They do not. You wake up every day and you know they're there, and then they remind you throughout the day that they're there. So they do not leave at all. Seiya Suzuki, the Cubs. This one surprised me as well, because like all the rumors for like 3 or 4 days, San Diego, San Francisco, maybe Boston, San Diego's here. And then he goes and signs with the Cubs. So I think it was obviously he was looking for the best cash amount, I'm assuming, because he wants to cash in. It makes sense. But he's going to play every day in the friendly confines over there. So any thoughts on Seiya Suzuki, who we're all obviously just speculating because nothing ever transitions perfectly from overseas to here?
Yeah, this is one of those things, talking about our projections, as we were at the top of the show. Normally, in a sort of quote-unquote regular year, I probably would not have put up any projection for Suzuki until he signed with somebody. But, you know, given where his ADP was during the lockout and given how sort of obvious it was when he didn't go back and re-sign in Japan when the lockout got kicked in, it was clear that he wanted to come. So if he was willing to wait out the lockout, then he was clearly going to sign on the other side of it. So I threw up a projection for him in, you know, late January or something like that. And not knowing what to do, I put up a park neutral projection for him. And it actually, that projection, which was in place for, you know, 6 or 7 weeks, actually went down a tick the other night when I converted it over to the Cubs. So he's now, I think I had him at 21 home runs before, not knowing where he was going to land. Now he's at 19. He's got 8 stolen bases. We've got him hitting .255, but that's all, like you said, there are wide error bars on those, because it seems like, first of all, we don't have enough sample size of guys coming over, let alone at different ages, different profiles, to figure out, you know, what really good conversion factors are for these. And, you know, then you get into the fact that they're all individuals and all of the cultural things that come along with it. And with the pitchers, you talk about the different size ball and the 6-man rotation and all that stuff. It's, you know, it's apples and oranges. They call them both baseball, but you know, in some sense, the similarities end there, right? So yeah. We'll see what happens. It's an interesting landing spot for him. It's a lot of money, but you know, the Cubs had tons of money to spend, but are not trying to win now. So it seems like, you know, making a 5-year commitment to a 27-year-old fits their time horizon more than some of the other things they could have done.
And it puts butts in seats because now you got a name that people can come see. It's not like you went and, you know, signed Corey Dickerson and some other guys. No offense to Corey Dickerson, who's probably an avid listener to the show. But, but you know, you get Seiya Suzuki, that's a lot of jerseys you can sell. There's a lot you could do with that. You could have, you know, Japanese Heritage Night. There's all kinds of stuff you could go. And it's because someone was asking me, because it makes sense. You know, San Francisco, San Diego, there's a lot of cultural diversity in these cities. It makes sense. But for those that haven't been to Chicago, there's a ton there as well. A ton. So it's probably the best Midwest location for him to go to in the grand scheme of things. So I could see it being a lot of it was a business move more than a baseball move, I have a feeling, for the Cubs, is the way I see this one playing out. But I'm looking forward. I hope he does well. We could use a new Ichiro type out there. I'd be 100%. All for it. So it'd be fun to see.
I was having, as you were talking about the you know, the marketing aspect of it, I sort of remember prior success with Japanese players with the Cubs. Was it Fukudome who, you know, really was not that good a
that
player?
That sounds about right, yeah.
Was not really that good a player, and I don't mean to equate him to Suzuki in that way. He wasn't super productive or anything, but I remember him being quite popular in Chicago. Oh, yeah. In the, you know, in the pre-Epstein rebirth, you know, lovable losers Cubs kind of mode. So, you know, there's some history of that there too. Again, he'll probably be a very popular player because, you know, there aren't that many other guys to root for on this team either. So, you know, they've kind of cleared the deck for him.
Definitely. Most definitely. Let's go to the Royals. Talking about a guy kind of a couple more years left in that arm, I have a feeling, is Zach Greinke, who, you know, the strikeouts dropped tremendously last year. He was getting it done with just kind of his, I'll just say moxie. He was just making it work, low 4 ERA. It was nothing flashy, but he has 8 innings for the Astros. He's going to do that very well for the Royals. He's going to mentor a very young staff. I thought it was a great move for the team to have him there, and it's a small market, which we know Greinke loves, all these things. His ADP is around 310 in the month of March. I just avoided him, but is there any interest in a guy like Greinke who will eat up a lot of innings and maybe can find another couple, you know, another year under his belt back in Kansas City?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right on. Again, I was talking with my guy Patrick Davitt this afternoon about this, and we came down in roughly the same place as you did. He criticized me for being a little disparaging and comparing him to the old spitballer from Major League who's out there on the mound.
The Vaseline and Crisco.
Crisco in his back pocket, the whole thing. You know, Patrick thought that was disparaging, but I thought it still kind of got
pretty accurate, I bet.
You said moxie. I backed off the Vaseline and said guile, but, you know, same thing. And, you know, but you're exactly right. You know, in addition to how comfortable he's going to be there just from familiarity and loving the market and the size of it and what he can teach the young guys there about, you know, he's notorious for, you know, the level of preparation and film watch he does, and he can pass along some of that. On top of all of that, when you've got this young staff that the Royals have that they want to protect, they need innings. And the great thing about Greinke, even though he's slopping it up there at 87, for a 39-year-old, he's still been very, very durable. He threw 170 innings last year. Guy never goes on the IL. He never, you know, never has a rotator cuff problem, never pulls a muscle. You know, they'll run him out there every fifth day, and there's a pretty good bullpen behind him. He'll take the ball and, you know, let them and, you know, live with their innings caps on Daniel Lynch and Brady Singer and Carlos Hernandez and Asa Lacy if he's up later in the year or whatever. It makes all the sense in the world. And yeah, sure, I'm probably more interested in the fantasy value than I was somewhere else because he'll go out there and, you know, his K per nine may be terrible, but his raw strikeout total may not be bad. And guess what? We play raw strikeouts, not K per nine. Right?
His raw strikeouts will be good. If he's like going around pick 310, he's like, he might be a bench starting pitcher for you. Sure. He might not even be one of your. So literally, you get to say, oh, hey, we're going to start him versus the Indians or Guardians this week.
100%.
Like he's getting a great division for matchups in that regard as well. So it's not like the old days where you had to make that decision. You see my SP4, like pick 120 or something. It's a different animal where in a bench SP with an ERA of like 4-1 is pretty darn good, actually. because most guys you stream are in the fives. And so that's why I've kind of come around on it. I think this is one of the better landing spots he could have had. I think it's
you're exactly right. I think our projection is around 4-1 or something like that. But that's the full season projection. You spot start him and you'll get a 3-5 out of him in 15 starts across the Central and in Oakland. And you sit him in Boston, New York, and Toronto and Tampa, and you're getting good mileage out of him. I think there's for the guys at the end of your bench like that, you want to have some utility for when you're going to be able to use them, either because of good divisional context or a Rocky starter you can use on the road, or a Miami starter who can you can pitch at home with confidence. You want some portion of their season where they're going to be attractive to use, and you got that with Greinke.
Most definitely. Another issue we have because of the wonderful lockout we experienced for 99 whole days is medical news is coming out in bunches. And it's been like, the free agent stuff's been fun, but some of this medical news, including Fernando Tatis Jr., who had a broken wrist. And when someone asked, well, which motorcycle accident, he said, which one? So he's had more than one, which should be terrifying. And he needs to go talk to Jeff Kent about being quiet for your contract's sake. But he actually had surgery on Wednesday. He went under the knife, got it repaired around 3 months, give or take. And then you hope his power comes back and everything. I'm not drafting him. Let's put it that way. So how are you looking at Fernando Tatis Jr.?
I wasn't drafting him before this.
Yeah, neither was it. Shoulder scared me.
Shoulder scared me. And, this is not me taking a victory lap, but I was scared. And, the worst has already happened. I had people who point out that he's been an incredible healer from his past injuries. That's entirely fair. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he beats 3 months and comes back and gives us a, vintage 2/3 of the season. But, I think his ADP is still falling. I don't think it's found bottom yet. And, it's not yet in a range I'm even remotely interested, but I'm generally not somebody who's going to hang a, top 100 pick on a guy who I know is out for 2 months anyway, no matter what he's going to do when he comes back. I wasn't on Acuna either. And now Acuna is, a month ahead of Tatis in terms of timeline.
Yeah, and in the last couple of days, he's gone as low as pick 99 in drafts. So he's starting to fall. It's reasonable, I could see. I told someone, I think, earlier this week, I said, if you're in a draft champions, I can see the appeal. Because you can go draft extra shortstops, and then you have 50 roster spots, and you can bring him back in, July, hopefully, and then enjoy that. But in a redraft, it's tough. And someone, forgive me, whoever it was, mentioned when he came back from that shoulder injury last year, I think he only attempted, 4 or 5 stolen bases or something crazy where you're drafting him really thinking he's this 20 stolen base guy and he just might not be right now. So keep that in mind also.
That's the problem with having such a broad base of skills is, there's a lot of skill to lose, right?
Most definitely. A lot of skills to lose. And here he's probably healing quickly because he's young. Yes. But just remember that, folks. Jack Flaherty, he's not healing. He went for a second opinion on his shoulder. And if the first one's not good, that's usually not. That's why you ask for a second one, folks. Yeah. So just remember that one. Just remember, they don't ask for a second one when the first one's good. Again, these aren't victory laps, but I've had a hardcore list of guys that were injured and I didn't know news. I wasn't dealing with. And so I have zero Flaherty, thank goodness, but definitely not drafting him now.
Yeah, I also have zero Flaherty, and it wasn't even that I was that concerned. I could have talked myself into being interested. It was just that I very much liked the guys who were around him in the same ADP range. It wasn't even from Flaherty's off my list. It was just that there were other guys who I liked better, and I was getting a lot of, I'm trying to remember now, but he was in that or near that tier with Montas and Musgrove and Berrios and all those guys, and I've collected all those other guys I just mentioned multiple times, and every time I had to choose one of those over Flaherty, I was choosing column B.
Don't blame you at all on that one. In your backyard, Chris Sale, he's got the rib injury. They're saying a couple months potentially, but I've heard mixed reviews. Like he's going to start throwing again in a couple weeks, but then he might not throw for a couple months. You know much better than me. What's your thoughts on Sale, who went as low as 186 in the last couple of days?
Yeah, I got to stop taking victory laps because this is the place where I did.
Oh, I have a lot of Chris Sale. Yeah, I'm guilty of this. I love the value on Chris Sale.
Yeah, I was loving it. I was completely sucked in by the way the velocity had come back, like even in the postseason last year. It seemed like every time he went on the mound last September, October, he was, you know, the results weren't always there. The command wasn't always there, but the velocity was going up every time. And it just like he was, seemed like he was getting stronger. And with a normal offseason, I just really liked where he would be coming into this year. But, you know, you said the key words, wasn't a normal offseason, right? And they're being kind of cagey about whether Sale did something, you know, quote unquote wrong and trying to get himself ready without team supervision. And, you know, he was throwing on the side and apparently did this in a throwing session. Maybe he would have been, you know, it sounds like it happened pretty recently. Maybe he would have already been in camp in the second week of February and they would have, you know, had better eyes on him, or he would have, you know, shut something down sooner. You know, that's all water under the bridge at this point. But yeah, multiple weeks before he even throws. And I think it's a pretty safe bet that from the time he picks up a ball, it's more than a month until he's actually back in Boston making a start, because you're talking about, you know, side sessions out to rehabs and three or four rehab starts. Remember the rehab last year he did, you know, they were being very careful because he was coming back from Tommy John, but I think he, you know, he toured six different minor league ballparks or something like that. Yep. It was like he was driving his family across the Midwest while he was, you know, touring the ballparks of America at some point there. But, you know, it's, you know, I would throw a, you know, over under a Memorial Day right now.
It sucks. Yeah, because I'm with you. I was big on, I was drafting like as an SP2 in so many places. Yep. I loved like the strikeout appeal. I was like talking about the contact rates last year. And I'm like, he's coming off TJ. Everybody knows that. Like that's like a common trend, but the velocity was what I loved much, much more. So big bummer, big bummer. It might be fun to get later, but I don't know if I can afford a draft pick on him yet. Maybe he falls into like the mid 200s when you can start thinking about things, but it's tricky. Cause like you said, is before he even picks up a ball, he's going to ramp up again. It's dicey. Let's talk Atlanta Braves here. They've made a few moves. This one might be minor. I just want to get your thoughts, cause Colin McHugh was a pretty good long man for the Rays last year at times. And with this Braves rotation that has outside of Fried and Morton, some very young arms that could have some innings issues. Does a guy like Colin McHugh bring any fantasy interest to you in some leagues?
Yeah, I'd want to see, and this goes, I'll talk about it with McHugh, but I guess it applies to a lot of people. I'd kind of want to see how the usage pattern pops in the first, you know, 2 weeks of the season. There's an opportunity there, like you, for exactly the reasons you say, that, you know, and the usage pattern with McHugh in Tampa, where he was very effective, so you would think they would keep it, was, you know, every third day kind of thing for multiple innings. You know, they weren't running, he's not going to be an 80 appearance guy. He's going to be a, you know, 55 appearance, 90 innings sort of thing, I would imagine. And if you put that into a place where he's the second guy in after all the kid starters, and don't forget that everybody, I'm always mindful of the team that, you know, went to the World Series and everybody kind of blew every innings limit last year, right? Because they were trying to get a ring, and they're gonna try to take the foot off the gas on a bunch of these guys, even Morton, who's coming back from injury, maybe even Fried, you know, let alone the kids. You know, there's a lot of opportunity for him to come in and get the last out of the fifth, pitch the sixth and into the seventh, and end up getting the win, right? If there's a short list of people I'm looking at who could be Brent Suter and get 12 wins in that role this year, McHugh's on my list for sure. You know, but again, want to see how they use him, because they could also fall into, you know, he's so effective, they could also fall into a situation where they think that, you know, he's able to, you know, he's better used in the seventh and the eighth, and he's not the guy who's picking up the vulture win in that scenario.
And we're talking about the Rays here, who pitch usage and consistency of using pitch usage is so common with them. Like, who's their closer? Who's this guy? They mix things up all the time. I don't know. We're talking Atlanta. Right. Never mind. That was with Tampa Bay. Atlanta might be a little more disciplined. Thank goodness. But I was trying to find it.
Bullpen.
Yeah, they do. And I was trying to find it. I couldn't find it. Jason Collette, when the move happened, I tweeted something and he commented, and he's Mr. Ray, so he knows these things. He mentioned something about McHugh's usage last year. It was like 23 of 32 appearances or something, were 2 to 3 innings each. Had some pretty deep, it was some pretty interesting stats that really cleared things up. So, and the other thing you mentioned, the Brent Suter, who was tremendous, but I would love to like have some database that's probably impossible to find, is how many times was he actually rostered when he got one of those wins? Because you know, he probably wasn't very often. Like, we all talk about it, but McHugh, I think the best usage for him is probably not a draft pick, but he'll be one of those guys, especially like in NFBC leagues where you get those really, really sharp guys in 15-team leagues where it's like, well, the streaming options kind of suck this week. And so I'm going to go grab McHugh and hopefully, you know, Freedom Morton only have one start, but they have seven starts. So all the young kids are going, like, let's give it a whirl. That's my, you're grasping at straws, but that's kind of my guess.
I might take it a step further than that just because the, you know, one of the things you think about as you get closer to opening day is the schedule. And we're starting with that half week this year, right?
True. That's a good
until the Sunday lineup. And, you know, a lot of the smart players will grab an extra reliever in round 30 to be able to plop them in for those first 4 days, maybe sneak a vulture win while you rostered 8 or 9 starters, but only 4 of them are starting that in that half week, right? So yeah. McHugh's a great guy to do that. And maybe because, you know, today was the first day of, you know, pitchers actually throwing in games, so it remains to be seen what kind of pitch counts we're looking at on starters for their first time or two through the rotation. Maybe you grab a guy or two like this for the first 4 days and don't actually cut them for week two because you see that your fifth starter either not only does he not have a good matchup, but he's only stretched out to 75 pitches. At that point, it's kind of all downside. Hey, I'll leave McHugh in the lineup for a week and see what happens. And then bang, you're 10 days in, he's got 3 wins, and you're like, I'm really onto something here. You know?
Great point there. They made a couple other moves in the outfield. They signed Eddie Rosario, brought him back, which is a great move, I think. And then Alex Dickerson, former Giant, who is a decent platoon left-handed bat out there on a team as well. Eddie Rosario was one of the guys that I know Toby and I were saying was kind of a deal in drafts, and that ADP will climb. It's already climbed as high as 147 now since he's been signed. Any love for Eddie Rosario or Alex Dickerson in Atlanta?
Yes, some. And I'm trying to figure out, because I hadn't actually seen this confirmed yet, to me, sort of the big variable here, I mean, all these guys can play until Acuña comes back, right?
Yes.
And then on top of that, though, what are we clear that Acuña can go back into center field?
At least what the report that came out this afternoon from Anthropoulos, he said the goal is by April 21st to have him DHing, by May 21st to have him in the outfield. Wow. He said that could change, but that's the goal is May 21st for the outfield. So we're talking almost 2 months potentially of Acuña DHing or not playing at all.
Okay. So if we do that, then, I mean, there's no other real center fielder on this team. They were fooling around with Duvall in center field in the playoffs last year. Were they? Are they really going to do that for 2 months? Or
it'd be a bad move.
You can't put Rosario out there.
You definitely can't put Ozuna out there.
Point being, that might be why Dickerson is here, right? Because maybe he can do that. And if it's not him, it's Drew Waters, which is, you know, pretty bleak. So, I'm interested in Dickerson, and based on what you're saying, I'm looking at our HQ depth chart right now. We've got him at 40% playing time. That's probably front loaded while Acuña is out. Yep. I'll buy that. That's 60 or 70% playing time in April and May, he's rosterable.
Yep, definitely. And then if it changes, drop him. Very simple.
Totally.
The Giants, this move I was kind of torn on at first, but after seeing what the Giants are doing for his brother with Down syndrome and other things, I'm all about this move. It's pure. And I saw like videos and pictures of him in camp today. I'm like, okay, I'm good. Jock jams in San Francisco, as annoying as the strikeouts can be at times and everything else. It's fun. And to me, it's as simple as he fills the Alex Dickerson role for the Giants. Yep. That's what I see. So if you rostered Dickerson at all for the Giants last year, he's usually in certain weeks where he's going to Colorado or something. Otherwise, I think that's pretty much what you can get from Jock jams, unless you have more insight on that.
No, I think that's about right. This also answered another question for me that I had there, which was I got some questions from our subscribers during the lockout because we had a pretty high playing time projection on Darren Ruff. Because there was nobody else there, because we had moved Dickerson out, he wasn't coming back, and we didn't have anybody in the Peterson role. Ruff, did really well when he came back last year. And in particular showed more skill against righties than he had ever had before he went to Japan, right? So the question in my mind was, can they actually make him 70% playing time guy playing against both lefties and righties? Jock Jams arriving basically answers that question as no. Yep. so now we know.
That was my argument all draft season. I was like, I try to keep my fandom out of things, but everyone's like, oh, Darren Ruff. I'm like, he's not playing every day, guys. Yeah. Like everyone kept trying to tell me like he's not. Like I loved watching him. It was a great story. He's not playing every day. So yeah. Like unless he can play first base, because they're not going to put him in the outfield every day, no matter how good he's hitting. Like they're just not with that defense. That is not going to happen. The Cubs. This is a move that has been very, at least in my little chat groups, has been controversial. They went and signed Jonathan Villar. Me, and you can totally tell me I'm wrong, huge fan of this. As all the possible landing spots for a guy like Villar is multi-positional, a little bit of pop, got the speed, get him late in drafts, all the things you look for from Villar. This works as a pretty good location. If you have a different thought or you agree, just tell me what your thoughts are on Villar to the Cubs.
Yeah, I'll mostly agree with you. I think it makes a lot of sense. I couldn't, when they first announced it, I couldn't quite figure out what they were trying to do with him, because it doesn't make sense to block Madrigal or Horner, and they just signed Simmons for shortstop. VR is not really a shortstop anymore anyway. But he can play the outfield. He can play third base. You know, the Cubs have guys at all those places, and they're guys they need to, you know, for the most part, figure out what they have there. But they can do that, accomplish all of those things, and still have plenty of role for VR. And I mean, you know, VR is older now. You know, he's not the same guy he was when he made me boatloads of money back in 2016 when he, you know, showed up in Milwaukee and stole 45 bases. But
glorious year.
It was just, I mean, it's one of my favorite, one of my random favorite years of all time. But, you know, the thing about VR that I, you know, that this reminds me of is VR, you know, this is sort of I'm not much of an NBA fan, but there are comparisons to the NBA where there are guys who are really good on bad teams. Mm-hmm. VR is a fantastic bad team player. You know, he had that monster year or two in Milwaukee. He was good at Baltimore. Yep. You know, if you have a good team, you don't want him anywhere near you. But, you know, if you're slogging through 67 and 95, you know, turn VR loose and he'll make good things happen. And, you know, there's that kind of potential here.
I think he'll be better than this, but again, I'm biased. Maybe it is because I enjoyed that same summer with the Brewers you did, and I just can't get it out of my mind. He could be the Matt Duffy on this team, and he played a ton last year. And sure. And that's very popular. Like Wisdom, they need to see what he's got, but we also know he strikes out a million times.
Right.
And like, there's questions there. All it takes is one injury to anybody in the infield. He can play the outfield. So that's why I'm intrigued. I know I see the pros and the cons, so we're pretty much on the same page there. Rob DiPietro wanted me to ask you, how did I get a Murphy to podcast on St. Patrick's Day?
you invited me a month ago, and we batted around four dates and settled on here. Yeah. And oh, by the way, it's March. I'm not allowed out of my office anyway, so it's fine.
Yeah, Rob, just be glad you didn't go to the Mets. Okay, you're good. Michael Givens. Now, this one kind of surprised me. Maybe I'm overthinking this, but Michael Givens signing with the Cubs again. The Cubs have question marks everywhere, and Hewer was one guy they thought would be the potential closer. He's obviously done for the season. You still have Rowan Wick, who's kind of been a good and bad at times pitcher, so there's question marks there. And Givens has shown, even with the Reds as early as last year, was pretty good in the back end of ball games. So do you have any interest in maybe a late shot on him as a potential sneaky saves asset?
I don't think so, only because I like other guys more here. You know, I have a little bit of faith in Wick, and my hobby horse here, because I listen to Doug Dennis from our staff, our bullpen analyst. My hobby horse here is Braylon Marquez anyway, I've got still above Givens in the pecking order. But that's not to say that, you know, spin the wheel enough times here and it doesn't land on Givens for a while. Obviously, you know, Givens has had stretches in his career when he's, you know, had the job and held it down. It is interesting what the Cubs are doing here, though, because they seem like they're trying to put together a competent bullpen. Maybe this is all
they're all trade chips.
They're all trade trips, and they had to spend some money because of the the minimums in the CBA and all of that with the revenue sharing. So they decided to sign some stuff that they might be able to turn into draft picks on July, future prospects on July 31st, I suppose.
Yep, pretty much. Same question, could be just overthinking things. But like Andrew Chafin, we saw great in the back of the Cubs pen, pretty good in the back of the A's pen, goes to Detroit. And, you know, everyone's anointing Soto, and I have a lot of Soto shares, so I'm kind of hoping it's Soto. But there's concerns with Soto. He throws pitches like 50 cents sometime when he's throwing them out there. Mm-hmm. So it's like you could see an avenue where Chafin could kind of usurp him in this situation. Is there any interest in a guy like Chafin?
Yeah, I'm somewhat interested here. Like you said, Soto is a box of chocolates, shall we say. I'm fairly high on Fulmer, I think. And one of the things, I've made this point in a couple of places this winter, but one of the things I'm watching with this team in particular is the, I don't think I've seen this confirmed yet, but the news that came out the other day that the Ghost Runner might be coming back after all, which affects how bullpens get used. And I have this recurring thing where I kept seeing last year that it really seemed to me like when Fulmer was healthy, Hinch wanted him to be his 10th inning guy. Yeah. And I think, you know, better stuff than Soto, you know, might be able to blow people away with the runner on second, et cetera, but also had more confidence in him for multi-inning roles. He could come in and get the last out of the 10th or a good pitch of the 10th and the 11th if he needed to. But if that Ghost Runner comes back, I get more interest in Fulmer because he's got more paths to value there because I saw how he got used there. And either Soto melts down and Chafin or Fulmer might actually work their way into saves, or he could be another Brent Suter candidate for the 12 wins.
True. I do like the Fulmer talk up there, though. Definitely agree with you there. He was a heavy DC target at times because I could see a lot of avenues for him being some fantasy value. There was a trade, another trade. It could be totally minor, no pun intended here. But Mike Minor goes to the Reds. Amir Garrett goes to Kansas City. Minor's going to get his innings regardless if you like him or not. I'm not the biggest Minor fan, but I get it. The main question, at least for me, is similar to the last two we just had. Now you got Garrett there. Everyone loves Barlow. I like Stallmont to get another chance personally. But we know Garrett's pretty lethal too. So is there any interest in either Minor or Garrett from a fantasy standpoint?
Yeah, I'll throw Dylan Coleman into the hopper too, who I also like there. But and I guess that kind of makes the point is you've got Barlow, you got Stallmont, you've got Coleman, now you've got Garrett, you give him, so now you've got a lefty to work with in that mix. And, you know, if there's one thing we know about Mike Matheny's sort of 2.0 managerial career here is that he's not going to stick with one guy. You know, he might ride Barlow for a few weeks. He rode Barlow for the second half last year, but that was mostly because the other options were, you know, not effective at the time. And, you know, if you gave me the over-under on 4 or 5 saves for Garrett this year, just situationally, I'll probably take the over. Doesn't mean I think it's going to be more than 7, but, you know, I think there's every opportunity that, you know, they use Barlow in a situation where they want him and Garrett comes in behind him. Again, throw the Ghost Runner into this. That's a whole other wrinkle. You know, but this is – it's a pretty good bullpen, and it's managed pretty creatively. So, there are many possibilities.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Corey Dickerson to the Cardinals. Seems like a minor move, but again, it could clog up things. Lars Nootbaar might be a thing of the past again. Any fantasy impacts from Dickerson to St. Louis?
I guess I get a little worried here that the ripple effects here go to the DH spot. And, you know, so much of the chatter we've heard this winter about this is how Nolan Gorman gets his at bats, that, you know, now if Nolan Gorman has a rough couple of weeks to start the year, if he is in fact a DH, that, you know, they have a quote unquote professional left-handed hitter who can step in and fill that role. The defense is so good in the outfield that I feel like they're not gonna, you know, I don't feel like he's gonna steal, you know, starting outfield at bats from any of the incumbents, but certainly, you know, left-handed hitting, fourth outfield DH, who could probably even fake first base if they ever needed somebody to with Goldschmidt. He'll find his at bats here. You can see why, you know, if he had multiple offers, this is where he settled. Our at bat projection right now is 317 at bats, which is, you know, a pretty typical Corey Dickerson year, right?
Yeah, definitely is. And that might not be draftable, but definitely streamable at times during the season, because there'll be some prime matchups with like not many lefties on the week or something. And we know what he can do. He can get in grooves. So he becomes quite interesting once we see kind of the usage. that he puts out there. A couple of just food for thought things. So with the A's and the Reds trading everybody, and there might be more to come by the time this drops tomorrow, like there might be more trades. That's just like Montas and Manaea are getting shopped pretty heavily like right now. And there could be like, I still think Sean Murphy could even, like if you have a pulse and more than a couple $1 million on your books, here's a chance you could be going. That's just the way it is. So when you look at their roster, like you got the Tony Kemps, the Seth Browns, who's kind of interesting to me. Eric Thames might even get some run now. Like, Elvis Andrus is Elvis Andrus, but he's going to play every day. Is there anybody on this A's team that they're all pretty much draft day values now that is of interest to you? Because it's the old running joke that many of us have said is even bad teams produce fantasy value. Like that's just the way it is. So any thoughts on any of these guys that might stand out to you now with increased or locked in playing time?
Yeah, you hit on my favorite one already, which is Brown. I've been he's a guy I've been collecting a ton of in DC. He's just kind of saw this coming, and he's versatile enough that he can, you know, between DH first base and faking a corner outfield, that you figured that as the fire sale happened, that there are paths to playing time for him, and they seem to have opened up at this point. It's not like this organization has any interest in, you know, re-signing Mitch Moreland or anything like that at this point, right? They've got Eric Thames here, and you know that helps a little bit at first base, but there's still plenty of room for Brown. And you know, it's not just an opportunity thing with Brown. There's actually some skill there too. He's displayed some power skill. The other thing we got to do is keep an eye on who arrives on this roster, right? Because I think a lot of jobs are still open, and we're making some assumptions. Like I, for lack of an alternative, our depth charts say that Kevin Smith, who they just got from the Jays, is the third baseman right now. I mean, that's today's reality. It may not be tomorrow's reality. I think I made a joke with Patrick this afternoon, like I was saying on the other on our show, that you know maybe Jonathan Villar signs here. Well, Villar went to the Cubs,
a little bit of good fit,
but there are there are other guys like that around, and you know some of them are going to show up here, some of them are going to come back in the trades for Manaea and Montas. They did just pick up Billy McKinney, who you know was kind of got pressed into service with the Mets, when everybody on the Mets was injured last April and May, and he had a .192, but he hit 9 home runs. 260 at bats, and you give him a little BABIP correction there, and there there's some life in that bat. He could get 300 at bats here if depending on who they bring back in, and there are more guys coming. I think this is one of these places where you want to keep an eye on how this roster changes, because there might be a waiver claim or something like that on the Friday night before your Saturday draft that sort of tells you who the third baseman is, and it might be somebody you care about.
Yeah, it might be, because if it is Kevin Smith, like I started looking at him, 21 homers, 18 stolen bases last year in AAA, walked over 11% of the time. Sure, it's AAA and everything, but that's still pretty impressive. He's had power speed pretty much throughout the minors. So it'd be interesting. It'd be interesting to see if he got some healthy run there, to see how that would play out. And we don't need to go into the pitching, but just so people pay attention. With the trades already, Dalton Jeffries and Paul Blackburn into the rotation, there could be many more to take place there, but those might be more streamable options than actual draft day picks. But I want to go to Cincinnati now, where it gets fun, because you still have India there, Naquin, Votto, Stevenson, Moose, where they just brought in Colin Moran. You have Jake Fraley. They're saying Nick Senzel's healthy. Don't forget Shogo Akiyama and Aristides Aquino are still around, flashes from the past. Any interest there from the main guys of like Votto and India?
I've had what can really only be described as a fetish for Jake Fraley for the last couple of years. Like anytime he looked like he was about to get 2 weeks of run in Seattle, I was fabbing him everywhere. And it just drips power and speed and a batting average. It might start with a one, right? But it's super interesting. And hey, in this ballpark, anybody who's going to play, you sort of got to take semi-seriously. So I would love nothing more than to see Fraley get 350 at bats here. And he'd probably go 20-20.
You got Tyler Naquin, though. I wanted to just ask you, ADP at 319, as high as 262 in March, potentially going to hit cleanup in this team or third. Does he move up any draft boards for you? Or is it just like it's still Tyler Naquin? And he had a good run last year, but it's Tyler Naquin.
He did have a good run. It's interesting. And, one of the things about this team is going to be like you said, you rattle through the lineup. They're still going to score some runs as long as Votto and Idia there. At least the top of the lineup is going to be representative.
It's like the Cleveland Guardians from last year. Yeah. Top heavy.
Yeah, totally. You got plenty of run out of Rosario at the and Ramirez and
Framil.
And Framil, yeah, absolutely. Yep. And you know, even Miles Straw, popping up there in the second half of the year. There's room. That's a great comp. There's room for that kind of productivity out of at least the top half of this lineup. And Stevenson's probably going to bat like four or five. Yep. I don't think he's impacted by this much. You know, he's still going to get plenty of run, and he's still pretty interesting to me. So they'll score some runs, but they'll give them up bunches too.
Yeah, defense will still be very bad, folks. Very, very bad. Got a couple listener questions for you here, and then we'll wrap it up. But we have Tim Immel. He asks, how does Matt Chapman's move to third base, and how does it affect him overall for the trade? We talked about that, so we're good. We got Matt Chapman out of the way here. So, Tim, we got you. Simon P. asks, who do you see in the Yankees rotation now that Herman is out of the way as like the number four and fives? Because he's out until at least looks like mid to end of May.
Yeah, that was a 60-day DL, right? So, yep. And then, you know, there are so many, you know, they have the one horse and Cole. And after that, you know, durability question marks with everybody. Montgomery, Tyone, Severino looks like he might be on track, but you know, there are certainly some more hurdles to clear there. Cortez is, I've sort of thought of him as a smoke and mirrors guy, but he's going to get an opportunity to prove that right or wrong. And after that, I mean, Davey Garcia just disappeared last year, but we might see him at some point. And you know, Clark Schmidt and Michael King, and then don't forget the Luis Hill for sure. And then, you know, the Yankees are not shy about the opener either. No. And they could run, they could run Chad Green out there for two innings and take bullpen days whenever they want as well. And, you know, with 13 pitchers on your team, you can get away with doing that for stretches at a time, especially if you line it up so that you have your bullpen day and then Garrett Cole the next day for 7 2/3 is, you know, you can make that work.
And I hate to break it to people, I wouldn't be shocked if somehow Luke Voit's wearing gold and green pretty soon and Montas or Manaea is in Oakland, or in New York. Just throwing that one out there real quickly. So
that makes all the sense in the world.
The Yankees could make a few more moves still, unfortunately. That's just the rough facts of the situation. James D. in the chat asks, is Adbert Alzolay coming back this year? It doesn't sound good. He will, but it doesn't sound good. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I've got him on a dynasty league, and I just moved him to my IL, and I think he's going to be there until August or something like that.
Yeah, they're saying like minimum 2 to 3 months, but it's a lat deal that does not sound good. And I didn't want to look at my roster share percentage on that because he was one of my favorite late round upside guys, and
that stings.
Yep, that was a rough one, but it is what it is. Then the breaks of drafting early, that happens. But Ray, we're going to wrap it up there, my friend. This was a great time, and before we leave, once again, plug everything at Baseball HQ and let them know like where they can find you and what's going on.
Sure. You can, easiest place to find me is at RayHQ on Twitter. And from there, I will direct you to all of my content on Baseball HQ. I have my annual Straight Draft Guide, which is a massive opus of not only my own sort of draft state of mind with ranking lists derived from our projections, but also one of the things I do, which I think is really important this year, is I also hyperlink the crap out of it and have put all of the what I call the required reading, all sort of the best of HQ from, you know, this entire offseason linked in one place, so that if you were one of the people who got too fed up and, you know, stuck your head under a rock during the lockout and then woke up last week and were like, oh no, I'm drafting four baseball teams, what do I do? Hey, this is where you got to go. I've got it all teed up for you. That's on, that's up on Baseball HQ on Friday this week. And I'll be cranking out more articles the rest of the month, a couple of draft recaps and what have you. And the rest of the team at HQ is, as we said at the top of the show, is, you know, gone from, you know, not on, we weren't on hiatus, but we were sort of in stasis. Slow playing it. And we've now put the pedal to the metal, and we have found mid-season form in the span of 8 days. So it's good times.
I got one more question for you, as Rob DiPietro dropped one as you were talking here. He said some teams like Baltimore, Cleveland, and St. Louis are mentioning stretching out some relievers into starters. How does this impact speculating on some fringe starters for you?
Yeah, you know, one of the we talked about the Ghost Runner a little bit, but one of the other rules that I think we're still waiting to hear about is whether we're going to get expanded rosters for April, right? And I think we probably are, and I think that probably is in play with what's happening here. I, you know, Rob mentioned Baltimore, and I know the one example that we saw is Ty Wells, who we thought was in the closer mix, is now being stretched out as a, you know, multi-inning guy of role to be determined, and, you know, other teams doing the same thing. And again, I think that goes back to with 14 pitchers on your roster for April, you can afford to play games and you don't have to have your, you know, 10th or 11th best guy on your staff throwing five innings and as a starter every 5 days. You can get away from that, and we're going to see more teams acting like the Rays for as long as they can get away with it. And maybe that'll just help them either manage innings limits, or maybe figure out that some guys are really good in this role. And come May, when the roster's reduced, maybe we'll see a couple of combinations of piggyback starters where, you know, your fifth starter is actually two guys going three innings each. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know, but I think there's been room for those kind of things to get tried out more in, in some corners of the league. And we're going to see some of that in April. And I'll be very curious to see whether it drifts into May.
Definitely. And that's what's so fun is like we switched from lockout to full bore. We still have so many questions, and we have like no time to answer them.
Basically. That's the thing. Like the fire hose is going so fast that, you know, the information is coming faster than we can process it, which, you know, is in some ways is a great mode to have to be in, because it's a truer test of something. It's not, this is not one of those situations where everybody is singing from the same hymnal and practicing the same strategies. There's plenty of room for variance and for people to catch things that other people missed.
No doubt about it. But on that note, we will wrap things up. Ray, I appreciate it. Long overdue. Thanks for joining me. We will definitely do this sooner than later next time.
I would love to be back anytime you want to have me.
All right, everybody. Again, go check out baseballhq.com. Go check out Ray Murphy on Twitter at RayHQ. This was Benched with Bubba, episode 451. We'll catch you guys next time.
Life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance, because you'll feel protected no matter how the wind blows. Also, you can keep enjoying the home of your dreams. And our expert agents can help you save up to 23% when you bundle home with auto. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit amfam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.